Picture a morning over occupied France, June 1943. A lone fighter is limping west at barely 150 miles per hour, trailing fuel and oil in long dark streaks across the sky. The cockpit glass is shattered, the canopy is jammed, the pilot is trapped inside and he knows it. And somewhere behind him, a German pilot has just used up the last of his ammunition on this airplane, pulled alongside to look at what he had done, raised his hand, and flown away east. The airplane that brought Lieutenant Robert Johnson home that day was a Republic P-47 Thunderbolt. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Let's talk about the jug. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, before the Thunderbolt ever fired a shot in anger, nobody was entirely sure it belonged in a war. The man who designed it was Alexander Kartveli, born in Tiflis, Georgia, back when it was still part of the Russian Empire. Came to Paris to study engineering, came to the United States with not much except a drafting pencil and a mind for aerodynamics that very few people have ever matched. He went to work for Seversky Aircraft on Long Island, New York, which reorganized into Republic Aviation Corporation. And in 1941, Kartveli handed the Army Air Corps something that gave the brass pause. The Thunderbolt was enormous, not just big for a fighter, enormous by any standard you want to apply. It was the heaviest single-engine fighter any nation had put into mass production. Fully loaded, it came in at close to 17,500 pounds. To put that in perspective, a Spitfire weighed around 7,500 pounds, a Messerschmitt 109, roughly 6,900. The P-47 was more than twice the weight of most of the things it would end up fighting. Pilots who first climbed into one had a word for it, the jug. Some said it looked like a milk jug from the side. Some said it was short for juggernaut. Both explanations made sense, and neither one was a compliment at the time. That weight came from a deliberate choice. Kartveli built the airplane around the Pratt & Whitney R2800 Double Wasp. 18 cylinders arranged in two rows, each one the size of your torso. At takeoff, it put out 2,000 horsepower. And behind that engine, Kartveli fitted a General Electric turbo supercharger that let the P-47 breathe properly above 30,000 feet, where most fighters of the era were already gasping. The turbo supercharger drove a design compromise that troubled engineers and impressed them in equal measure. The supercharger sat behind the pilot, connected to the engine by ducting that ran the full length of the fuselage. The whole arrangement made the airplane deep and wide, and the early mechanical reliability of the system was, to put it charitably, inconsistent. But when it worked, it gave the Thunderbolt an advantage the Luftwaffe did not expect from an airplane that size. First flight was May 6, 1941. The Army bought it. By early 43, the first P-47s were arriving in England in crates, being assembled in the English countryside, and the pilots of the 8th Air Force were climbing in and wondering what they had gotten themselves into. These were young men who had heard about the Spitfire. Some of them had flown Spitfires on loan from the British while the American groups got organized. A Spitfire was a thing of grace, responsive as a thought, a thoroughbred you could dance with at altitude. The Thunderbolt was not that. Pull the stick into a hard turn and it would comply, but heavily and deliberately, like a draft horse being asked to canter. There were jokes in the officers' mess. The running consensus was that if you got bounced by a German fighter, you had two realistic options: try to run or pick a soft field. The pilots who figured the airplane out would tell you the jokes were a failure of imagination. The key was altitude. Above 25,000 feet, the Thunderbolt was in its element, fast, responsive for its size, and in a dive, it was something no German pilot wanted to see coming out of the sun at them. The R2800 and the turbo supercharger together could push the airplane past 420 miles per hour in level flight, and in a dive it went considerably faster than that. Early test pilots discovered the Thunderbolt could approach the speed of sound in a dive, where the air gets strange and the controls get reluctant, and a few of them barely survived learning that. But in combat, a diving Thunderbolt was essentially uncatchable. Boom and zoom, the pilots called it. Come down from above with all that altitude converted to speed. Hit hard, use the energy of the dive to zoom back up to where you started. The Focke Wulf 190 and the Messerschmitt 109 were both excellent fighters, but neither one could follow a P-47 down in a full power dive, and neither one could catch it climbing back to altitude on that energy. You fought the Thunderbolt on its terms, not the enemy's. there was also the matter of the armament. 8 50 caliber Browning machine guns, 4 in each wing. When a P-47 lined up and opened fire, the target tended not to require a second pass. The outfit that made the Thunderbolt famous was the 56th Fighter Group, based at Halesworth in Suffolk, England. Their commander was a pilot from Montana named Hubert Zemke, Hub Zemke. If there was a man designed by nature to lead a fighter group, Zemke came close to the template, aggressive but not reckless, technically sharp, and he had the kind of authority that does not come from rank. It comes from the fact that everyone in the room understands this person is simply better at the work and knows it. Under Zemke, the 56th became what the press called Zemke's wolf pack, and they went to work on the Luftwaffe. One of his pilots was Francis Gabreski. Gabby, they called him. Son of Polish immigrants from Pennsylvania. And he had a particular reason to care about this war. Early on, he pulled strings to go spend time with Polish squadrons in England, studying how the Luftwaffe fought from the people who had been on the receiving end of it since 1939. He came back to the 56th. With knowledge you could not get out of a training manual in the Thunderbolt, Gabreski became the top-scoring American ace in the European theater. 28 aerial victories. He was precise, calculating, and as close to genuinely fearless as a man in that position could reasonably get. He almost made it home. July 20, 1944. Gabreski was flying what was supposed to be his last mission before rotating back to the States. His war was over, he made a low-level strafing pass on a German airfield, flew just a fraction too low, and the propeller of his P-47 clipped the ground. He belly-landed in a German field, stepped out unhurt, and spent the rest of the war as a prisoner. Came that close. But the story I want to sit with is Robert Johnson's, June 26, 1943. The 56th was on mission, and Johnson's P-47 was bounced by a Focke Wulf 190. The German hit him with cannon and machine gun fire, hit him again, and the airplane took it. Cockpit torn up, hydraulics damaged. The canopy took hits and jammed shut. Closed tight, Johnson could not open it. He could not bail out. He was locked inside a shattered airplane over occupied France with no option but to point the nose west and keep flying. The German stayed with him. Pulled alongside, had a clear shot, and fired again. The R2-800 kept running. Punched through with holes, damaged by cannon rounds. That engine kept pulling. The German fired until he had nothing left, and then he did something Robert Johnson could not explain. He slid the Focke Wulf alongside until the two cockpits were close enough that the men could see each other's faces clearly. He looked at Johnson. Looked at what was left of the P-47, and then he raised his hand. Johnson said later it might have been a salute, might have been a wave. He couldn't be certain. Then the German banked away east and disappeared. Johnson flew west. The English Channel is about 22 miles at its narrowest. On a normal day in a healthy airplane, that's nothing. With a jammed canopy and no functioning systems to speak of, that is the longest 22 miles you will ever fly. He made it. He put the airplane down at RAF Manston, the emergency field on the coast of Kent that existed specifically for aircraft in exactly his situation. The mechanics who came out to the airplane counted the holes. More than 200. They said later that by any reasonable engineering standard, the airplane should have come apart somewhere over France. The engine should have seized, the control should have failed. They didn't. That was the Thunderbolt. That was what the air-cooled radial engine meant in actual combat. Punch through the coolant lines on a liquid-cooled engine, and you might have minutes before it seizes solid. The pilot is calculating seconds while he scans for a field to put it down in. Punch holes in the R2-800, and the remaining cylinders keep pulling. Pilots came back to Halesworth with sections of cowling torn away, with rudders that barely answered, with instrument panels that were just broken glass and bent needles. At the center of it all, always was that engine, still turning. Robert Johnson scored 27 aerial victories before he rotated home. He came back to the United States, and he wrote a book about it with writer Martin Caden. They called it Thunderbolt. If you haven't read it, that's something to fix on a rainy weekend.
The German pilot was never conclusively identified. Johnson never learned his name. He thought about that raised hand for the rest of his life. Ammunition exhaustion was the practical explanation everyone offered. Johnson said in later years he never fully accepted it as the whole story. I understand the feeling. Now here's where it gets interesting about the 56th Fighter Group. By late 43 and into 44, the 8th Air Force's long-range escort mission over Germany was increasingly going to the North American P-51 Mustang with drop tanks. The Mustang had the range and the legs to go deep and come back. Other groups in the 8th Air Force made the switch. The 56th stayed with the Thunderbolt. While the rest of the command was converting to Mustangs, the Wolfpack kept flying the jug, and when the final tallies of the European air war were counted, the 56th Fighter Group was the top-scoring group in the entire 8th Air Force. In an airplane, the rest of the command had traded away. In the last year of the war, the P-47 found a second calling that suited it almost better than the first: ground attack. The later models, particularly the P-47D with the bubble canopy and underwing hardpoints, could carry 500-pound bombs and rockets. They went low and fast over German supply lines, rail yards, river crossings, and troop columns. German soldiers had a word for the fighter bomber that came out of nowhere at 500 feet, Jabos, short for Jagdbomber. When they heard a thunderbolt at low altitude, they ran for good reason. More than 15,000 P-47s were built before production ended. They flew in every major theater of the war: Pacific, Mediterranean, China, Burma, India, Western Europe. They served with the air forces of Brazil, the United Kingdom, France, the Soviet Union, and many others once the fighting was done. Cartveli went on to design the Republic F-84 Thunderjet and the F-105 Thunderchief. He was one of the most productive military aircraft designers in American history, and he worked into the jet age without missing a step. But the airplane that defined him was the one nobody wanted until they understood it.
Today, airworthy P-47s show up at Oshkosh and the big air shows, and hearing an R2-800 at full power on a low pass is something that gets under your skin in a way that stays there. It is not a subtle sound, it is not trying to be deep and thumping and massive, the sound of an engine that spent years deciding the war was not going to be the thing that stopped it. Restoration pilots who fly the Thunderbolt for the first time often say some version of the same thing, that they understand now. They get, in a way they didn't before, what it must have felt like to step out of a shot-up P-47 at Halesworth after a mission over Germany, to walk around and count the holes, to run your hand along the fuselage of an airplane that should not have brought you home, and to feel what you feel when something has fought as hard for you as you fought for yourself. Robert Johnson came home. Gabby Gabreski came home when the war ended. The men of the 56th came home at a rate that their equipment helped make possible. The jug brought them home. Much of what I've pulled together today comes from Johnson and Caden's memoir, Thunderbolt, records from the 8th Air Force Historical Society and the National Air and Space Museum's documentation on Republic Aviation and the P-47 program. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Safe landings.